is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, I have the pleasure of talking to William Loving about his new novel. It's his third, called Fells Point, and that's F-E-L-L-S, Point. For those of you who are listening who've never been to Baltimore and don't know that Fells Point is one of the neighborhoods, how are you, Bill?
I'm great. Thanks for having me on, David.
Well, it's a pleasure. I really enjoyed this book. And I do like Balmer, as they call it, when there are people who actually live there. As I recall, you can always tell when a non-native person calls it Baltimore, as opposed to Balmer.
Exactly.
Apparently, you're from there, I assume.
And I am. However, I've been gone quite a while. I live in California now. And I guess I've sort of reverted to saying Baltimore. I think I've lost much of my Baltimore accent.
Right. Well,
but
yes,
I know it when I hear it.
When I talk to you, you definitely do not have the Maryland kind of Baltimore Eastern Shore accent, which is interesting. You know, and some people keep their native speech pattern, but I think if you move around a lot, as it seems you have done, you pick up either standard American English or an amalgam of accents.
Yeah, exactly. In my case, I lived in Minnesota for 14 years, which is a very distinctive and different accent. And I've lived in California now for 27 years, which again is yet another accent. So it's kind of a hybrid, I guess.
Well, I think that kind of happens. I lived in Minnesota for a few years myself, many years ago. And for a number of years afterwards, people would say to me, are you from the Midwest? I grew up in the East Coast, but you know, you absorb some of the temper of the places that you live. So this is your third book. And I'm sort of interested in a way is what caused you to go back to your hometown to set a novel in at this stage of your life?
Yeah, well, all of my books are really generated from the idea of a place that has meaning to me. And my first book was set here in Los Angeles, the City of Angles, it's called, and it's set mostly in the homeless population in Skid Row. And then my second book, which came out last year, is called Blue Earth River, and that is set in Minnesota, where I lived for 14 years and where I went to college and met my wife. So this one, Fells Point, is set in my hometown where I grew up. So as you can see, I'm kind of moving west to east, retracing my steps, you know, because in my life, I've gone from east to west. I'm also going back in time, you know, from a contemporary book in Los Angeles to Minnesota, where I lived in the 1980s and 90s, and then all the way back to Baltimore, where I grew up. So all three of those, I think, are in a way an homage to a place that has meaning for me. You know, I wanted to kind of wrap my brain around living in Los Angeles, which is pretty much impossible to do. The place is so vast, but I wanted to throw in my two cents. And then Minnesota, which I've been away from for 27 years, but I still have tremendous fondness for that place, especially now with all of the bullshit they're going through. And I still have friends and family there. And my wife and I go back every summer to visit. So I really wanted to do something about Minnesota and try to capture my feelings for the place. And so with Fells Point, it's the same thing. It's a city that formed me, you know, as a child and young man. And I've been away a long time, and I really wanted to do some kind of an homage to great city.
It's interesting when you say that, because the character, Danny Doyle, the main character, and I think we're not giving away anything here. I mean, we're going to be really careful not to give away too much of the story, but that he has a heart condition that he's been told will, he kind of knows that his life is shortened at this point. And so he does kind of what you just described, which is he starts to explore the city that he lives in a way that he had never done before, which, you know, kind of is normal. We live in a place and take it for granted. And sometimes there's just more there than you realize, even though you've been you might have lived there your whole life.
That's right. That's exactly right. And I went back actually for my 50th high school reunion, not to age myself too much. And I spent several days, and I rented a car and drove around Baltimore to see, does the Baltimore of my memory that I'm imagining for this book, which I hadn't started writing yet, does it match the reality of today? And I was really astounded at how little Baltimore has changed in the decades since I lived there. And it's kind of a beautiful thing in a way. I was thrilled to see that. And it really kind of brought back a strong sense of nostalgia for me that this is really, you know, they call it Charm City. And it is very charming. I mean, it's not all the Baltimore that's depicted in The Wire, which is, you know, the public image of Baltimore now is a crime-infested hellhole, which is very far from the truth. I mean, it's got its big city problems, of course, but so much of Baltimore is just traditional and charming and friendly and open and welcoming and gracious. And, you know, I wanted to try to capture that.
Well, I think, and of course, you can't fail to mention that your love for the Baltimore Orioles comes through, as your character is pretty much a dedicated Orioles fan. Now, you can't tell from reading the book exactly when in time it's placed, although you probably had a particular period in mind. And I didn't go to the trouble of kind of archaeologically figuring out what era it could have been based on Orioles history, you know, seasons that are, you know, accurate to the actual history. Did you model the actual time that the book takes place in to the baseball seasons that are you're referring to in the book, or are they just made up?
No, that's a great question, because I had to kind of figure that out and be careful once I decided what to do. So the book is set in 2022. There's some references to coming out of the pandemic. So the Orioles games that Danny Doyle attends do exactly match real Oriole games from the season of 2022, even though the whole book is made up.
Right.
I just felt like I want to honor that. You know, I want the games to be the actual games against the actual teams that happened on that day. So that was kind of fun.
Yeah, it is fun. And of course, they're doing better than they're supposed to be doing in that particular season. I didn't look back, so I don't remember. And I'm a baseball fan. I love baseball. I pay a lot of attention to it. Game's on almost all the time. But I don't know, you know, I can't remember exactly what happened every year. It's like,
you know, to be an Orioles fan is to be a long-suffering Orioles fan. They haven't been in the World Series since 1983, which I point out in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And which, you know, absolutely gnaws at Danny Doyle, who's just hoping and praying that they can get back to the World Series before he dies.
But, you know, almost every fan, that's so resonant for so many people. You know, when those stories about Cubs fans,
right,
were, you know, thinking, and in fact, many Cubs fans didn't live to see the day when their team actually won a World Series. And then you have other teams, you know, I'm a Twins fan, you know, they haven't even been to the World Series since 1991. So it's your experience as an Orioles fan resonates probably for any number of other cities.
Plus, you know, and this is also true of Danny Doyle, my character. I grew up in Baltimore when the Orioles were the number one franchise in baseball, you know, from the mid-60s all through the 70s till their last World Series in 1983. For a good almost 20 years, they were in the World Series many times, won several times. And they were just a model franchise. And so I grew up expecting that.
Right.
And then, you know, when the team kind of went south and has been sort of out in the wilderness baseball-wise for a long time, despite their beautiful ballpark at Camden Yards, it's been kind of, you know, a painful, frustrating period. And I wanted to sort of get that out there in the book. And I know a lot of Baltimoreans and Oriole fans will probably sympathize with that.
Yeah, I think so. And it kind of goes, it, I think it adds to the kind of veracity of time and place that you're looking for. It doesn't have to be exact, but place is very connected to people's experiences of sports teams and music and in bars, as you have as a central element of this is a mysterious, interesting dive bar that Danny stumbles upon.
Exactly.
That becomes really a core element of the book, which we're not going to reveal in any, you know, in any complicated way. But I think that it reflects his, you know, he wants to explore Baltimore and find the, like the last real places that exist. And
right,
this is one, but it may not be one. And that is kind of a fun, you know, element of the book, which we can talk about, that you play around with what is real, what is identity, what is imagination, what's dream. I think identity is a really important part, because in this book, he begins to question his own identity.
His own sanity. Yeah.
Yeah. And so the reader is, you know, you're exploring his psychology and his beingness through the lens of the structure of the book itself.
Yeah, well, he's the character is lonely, never married, middle-aged guy, and he is alienated in many ways, and he's trying to find some meaning in his life now that he realizes that he may not have that much time left, and that maybe he's taken his time on earth a little too for granted now that he has this death sentence hanging over him. So the book is, there is kind of a journey aspect to it, even though it all takes place in Baltimore. He does a lot of wandering around the city in the sort of the classic hero's journey structure, trying to figure out, you know, what his life has meant and why is he so alienated and lonely, and his attempts to make connections with people that he feels like he squandered opportunities to do that over his life. And with time running out, he really wants to reach out and find something to hold on to. And then you're right, he finds this bar. He's got this bucket list of things that he wants to do before he kicks it. And one is to find the last authentic dive bar in Fells Point, which is a great neighborhood, a great waterfront, historic neighborhood, which has been gentrified in recent years. And it's a lot more touristy than when he was a young man growing up there. So he does. He finds this very peculiar dive bar, and eventually has some adventures in there, and begins to wonder. And his friends that he tells about this bar begin to wonder if he's just imagining the whole thing, if he's become delusional, if his loneliness and alienation has leaked over into hallucination and delusion. And I think, you know, that's a question I think the reader has to try to figure out as they're going along with it.
Right. And it becomes a kind of also a literary adventure, a kind of doppelganger story as well.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's all of my books I try to make successful on multiple levels. At least I try. I don't know if I always succeed, but all of them, I think, are meant to be page turners, that there's forward momentum and there are questions in the reader's mind that hopefully they really want to find out. But at the same time, I want to leave readers with something to think about when the book is over and have some kind of commentary about the human condition or the world we live in today and that sort of thing. So in this book, I'm also kind of playing around with some ideas about the nature of fiction and literature and the role of the author and the relationship with readers and characters and that sort of thing. So it was kind of fun to play around with those ideas.
Yeah. When we were talking beforehand, you referred to metafiction, and, you know, maybe that is something we can explore a little bit. What does that mean to you?
Well, metafiction to me, it's also sometimes called postmodernism or what have you. To me, it's when the author deliberately kind of breaks the fourth wall and doesn't pretend that this is, you know, this is real. I think the secret sauce of fiction for centuries has been write it in such a way that the reader gets lost in the story and forgets that they're reading a made-up story, that they really start living the story and believing in the characters and everything. Metafiction just kind of blows that up and says, you know, this is a made-up story and we're not going to let you forget it. And there's different ways that an author can do that. Sometimes the author will intrude on the story and make comments about the story that he or she is writing. There's a lot of different ways to do it. And I wanted to play around with that somewhat in this book without getting too much into how I did it.
Right. Rich, we will. Yeah, I think we can't really, you know, it's almost as if the book being a mystery in a certain way, you know,
right.
we talk about that element of it. We will be giving away things that readers should be able to find out for themselves. So we won't. But it's interesting to explore the notionality of, you know, the construction of a book and the identity of the author being the, not just the storyteller, but sometimes becoming the story itself. You know, as you said, the fort, you know, breaking through that wall creates the ability for the author to change the relationship with the reader also, as well as with the characters.
Right. There's one part that I think we can talk about, maybe dance around a little bit, is the fact that Daniel Doyle, and it says in the very opening line of the book, feels that he's being stalked. There's this strange guy who he's never seen before, suddenly is appearing everywhere in his life in kind of a creepy way. And he tries to, you know, track this guy down and confront him and say, who the hell are you and why are you following me? And eventually he becomes convinced that somebody is studying him to maybe make a character out of him in a book or something like that. And he gets into this sort of this anxiety and discussion about, is that ethical? Can you just copy somebody's real life and then turn it into a fictional character in a book? Isn't that a kind of theft? I think, you know, it's called appropriation these days. And there's some discussion of that, which I think is very timely and a hot topic in literature today. So there's a lot of ways to get in and out of interesting levels in the book.
Well, and that, I think that's an interesting element for any author or any reader to think about, which is, you know, every book in some level or another, every novel, let's say, a projection of the author's experience, and that will include real life. Everything can be made up in a novel. It is literally fiction, but nothing is made up without some experience prior to the making up, so the making of the book. And historically, many authors have had issues with characters in their novels who were based on real people that they studied very carefully, that only that person and potentially a few other people who knew that person would recognize the character. And that's, for many authors, has created tensions and complaints from real life characters. I've been a character in somebody's fiction at one time, and it can be a little disconcerting for the person who's both real and fictional.
Exactly. And I think fiction writers, you know, we make up these characters, we give them, you know, fake names, and we invent a backstory for them and try to construct a personality. But we always are drawing aspects from people we know. You know, I think that's true, that nobody makes up a character completely out of thin air. I mean, we all have people in our lives that we know, people we've just observed, and those impressions, those memories of people embed themselves in our memory. And even if we think we're making up a character, you know, we're drawing on our memories of people that we've known. and they're in there. And the question becomes to me, what is the author's responsibility at that point?
Yeah.
You know, at what point is it kind of harmless amalgamation? And what point are you really just kind of robbing somebody of their story to put in your book and sell to the public and maybe make a few bucks on it?
And think about this, you know, in both in historical times and even at any time, taking a photograph of someone is a fraught thing. A photographer who is creating an art photography. I'm not talking about snapshots, although even that, if you take a picture of somebody and then you put it up on your Facebook page without their permission, have you appropriated them for your narrative? Or if you take a photograph on the street in New York, as some famous street photographers have done, and then you publish that, A, you're building a reputation, B, you might be selling the book and making money. So the subject of that photograph has something to say. And so there's a literal comparison there that I think applies to fiction too, that it's a less realistic representation because a photograph is not manipulated in some way as fiction can manipulate memory and characteristics of a person that you perceive. And by the way, perception of another human is unique to you as the perceiver in some ways. You know, you could say to the subject, only I see you in this light. That may not be how you perceive yourself or how anybody else perceives you. So you really can't complain about my perception because it's not really you anyway. It's my perception of you.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think that's true in fiction, where a person might be able to say, you can't include details from my life in your book. They belong to me. You know, it's my story. But then the counter to that is an author can say, yeah, except we interacted in real life. I know you, or we've crossed paths, and you entered my life at that point. So my experience of you became part of my story. So it's as much my story now as it is yours.
Right. Well, in that sense, we are all characters in someone's story, and they are all characters in our stories.
Right.
The difference is that an author constructs an artistic creation from that, as opposed to someone who's simply living it and not in some form or another using it for their own purposes. You know, I remember I took a writing class that I refer to constantly when I think about fiction, and that is the kind of conceit or structure of the class was to see fiction as a strategy of indirection by the writer, because your fiction itself is an indirection. Direct experience is what we, you know, that's nonfiction, but fiction is indirect. And so it's being manipulated by the author in some way. Life is being recreated in that indirection.
Sometimes it's recreated in a way that authors wish the world was really like. You know, it's like creating an alternate reality, which is similar to the experience that readers have, you know, when they lose themselves into a novel. If they really like the novel and it resonates with them and they can't put it down, they have entered an alternate reality that they might prefer to the reality that's going on out there in the real world right now. And I find that as a writer, as an author, it's the same thing. When I write a book, a novel, I feel like I now can create an alternate reality that I want to live in. You know, while I'm writing this thing, I actually go into this world when I write it. And sometimes I enjoy that world a lot better than the actual world I'm living in. And I think that's part of the magic of fiction.
Right. And so a kind of fiction is a way that you can indirectly resolve issues that concern you as the writer.
Absolutely.
So, it gives you that power, which is pretty interesting.
I've been asked several times when I do author events, when people find out that I spent almost 30 years as a newspaper journalist, and they say, well, why did you turn to fiction? You know, if you were a journalist, aren't you more interested in facts and current events and that sort of thing? And this is, you know, from my first book, which was set in the homeless community of Los Angeles, I felt like I wanted to contribute something about this crisis that we're living in all over the country, but especially here in Los Angeles, and explore some of the questions about why do we have, you know, such callous disregard for the marginalized, and why we seem to be so unable to do anything about this in the richest country that's ever lived, and so on and so forth. But you know, I didn't want to write a polemic, or I felt like there's already plenty of people writing journalism and books and about it that I didn't need to add my two cents. So I wanted to explore it in a novel, you know, and that was an opportunity for me to maybe bring this reality that's most people don't see unless you happen to drive through Skid Row in Los Angeles or whatever town you live in. They're mostly out of sight, out of mind. And I wanted to bring people into that world through the, you know, the page-turning, tension-filled magic of fiction. So I've stuck with it. You know, I've been at this 10 years now, writing fiction, and I guess I wish I'd started earlier, because I find it to be a very powerful and compelling way to think about things and share my thoughts with others.
Well, I suspect that if you looked back, you'd probably see, or maybe I'm making a presumption, but I think that nonfiction writing, journalism, that experience, I think, contributes to your ability to write realistically about places and people, because your observational skills are enhanced when you're a journalist.
Right. That very much reflects my prose. I'm not a poet. I never attended a creative writing MFA program. My prose is pretty mostly direct and straightforward. I think that's that newspaper training that sort of teaches you to value clarity over mystery, you know, and maybe story over style. So I write in a direct and I hope clear and compelling way, but I try to make the ideas that are contained in that prose to be somewhat sophisticated, I hope, and deep, and maybe even profound if I've done it right, and hope to give readers something to think about after the book is over.
Well, I think I can attest that you have done that with this book. And I think that I'm glad that you said that just now, because it really resonates for me as a reader. Nice job. So, well, this is perfect timing, because this is sort of the place where we have to end it. I really want to thank you for being on the show.
Well, thank you, David. This has been fun. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. No, it's a really fun book. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk, your host. I've been talking to William Loving about his novel, Fell's Point.